Misfits. On today's episode, we're discussing Ask Me About My Uterus by Abby Norman, a memoir about one woman's eight-year quest to have her pain diagnosed. Be forewarned, not only are there spoilers ahead, but we talk about some very difficult topics in this episode. We also share your own stories about doctors not taking your or your loved one's pain seriously. We think this is a really important topic, and we hope you do too. So, if you're ready, let's get this party started. Hi, this is Maria Blackheart, and welcome to the Misfit Book Club, a podcast for readers, weirdos, uterus owners, normals, scribbling women, madmen, hysterics, screwballs, and every type of bookish person in between. This is episode 18, and I'm joined by my co-host, Pixie Berger.
Hello, my friend.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I have the song No Scrubs by TLC stuck in my head, and I don't know why.
Oh, my word. It's a brilliant song.
Right?
It's a masterpiece.
It's like, no, I don't want your number. No, I'm not going to give you mine. And no, I'm not going to take you nowhere.
Mm-mm.
No, I don't want none of your time.
So, fun fact, one of the Real Housewives of Atlanta wrote No Scrubs.
Are you serious?
Dead serious. Candy Burris.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yes. I remember her from all the episodes we watched together.
Yes, she was a member of the band Xscape, and she's written several songs, including No Scrubs, and she wrote some for Destiny's Child. So, like, she's actually really good and talented and has a lot of money.
We were going to grab a hamburger for supper, like, right before this, and I literally made my husband listen to it in the car while I danced in the car the whole way. I was just like jamming out. So good.
I love that mental image of you guys hanging out in the car in front of the Whataburger or whatever.
It was a Whataburger. How'd you know?
I just know you that well.
I love it. I'm also excited because it's summer reading season at our library.
Aww.
Where adults get to participate in summer reading club and win prizes. And I never win. But I always do it. It's so fun.
Do you keep track of points or what? How do you win?
Yeah, you earn entries for the drawing for every book you read. And for every 5 books you read, you get an entry into a grand prize drawing.
Amazing.
It's really fun. This is like my favorite time of year.
So good. I'm having a true summer love affair with the library as well. Our library is so fantastic and it has many branches. So if you want one of the books, you just kind of put in a little request and it shows up basically right on your doorstep. It's wonderful. And
that's amazing.
It is. And I just went on vacation with my dad for just a long weekend and I read 2 books cover to cover. We didn't even talk to each other. We just sat outside at the beach and read books and drank Heinekens. That was his decision.
That actually sounds wonderful.
It was fantastic.
Including the not talking to each other bit.
Well, yeah, you can't read and talk to each other.
I know. I love your dad. He's very sweet.
He's a character. That is for sure. Mm-hmm.
So you had a nice long vacation. Mm-hmm. What else have you got going on?
Fortunately, I'm still coming down from the very high of last weekend's royal wedding. I think I'm going to be living off of the joy and the thrill of that for some time to come, which thank God.
For the rest of my life.
Yeah, like thank God for a little bit of happiness. I'll take it.
Yeah. Okay, what was your favorite part?
Oh, that's so hard. My favorite part. Well, music-wise, I adored the gospel choir. They were so good and they looked amazing. It just, the whole package was incredible to me.
The choir director's hair was beyond.
It was beyond.
It was
so good. I loved the guy who played cello. He was wonderful.
Oh, he was just cute as a button.
Yes. And then the page boy who was carrying Meghan Markle's veil, who kind of photobombed her shot when she walked into the church and the trumpet started blasting. And he had this look of glee on his face. And I was like, boy, I feel it. I feel it.
I know. It was supposed to be like her grand entrance. And he was like, oh, my God.
I know. This like gap-toothed kid was like, ah!
He was all of us in that moment.
He was. I was so feeling it. And just generally speaking, I was not like too excited about that wedding. I mean, I was kind of excited, moderately excited. And I just loved the service from start to finish. I found it so warm and tender and just moving.
And that homily was fire.
Went to church.
I mean, that is the liveliest homily that has ever been had in Windsor. I guarantee it.
I bet so.
And afterwards, there's a really cute interview. It was the pastor who gave the homily, Bishop Curry, and then the Archbishop of Canterbury. And the Archbishop of Canterbury could barely contain his glee. Like, I'll have to find it and send it to you and post it to our social media, because the fire of God was in the Archbishop of Canterbury. It was like contagious. He was like, we need to be joyful. And he was like making these huge hand gestures. And you could tell that the interviewer was like, what is happening here?
I loved it. The royal family did not know what to do. But I can tell you that many an American Episcopalian that I know was so excited when they found out that he was going to be doing the homily at that wedding, because he's very popular.
I was like, I looked at my husband. I was like, I'm Episcopalian now. How did that happen? And I cried hysterically, which was so surprising to me because I wasn't really super invested in it. And I was so moved and so touched that I just started like crying. I was just like, this ceremony is so beautiful.
It was.
It is so important for people of color.
It felt like a very real love story. Which I am a hugely cynical person. You know this. And anyone who's listened to the podcast has probably figured this out by now. But I believed in love that day. And I'm going to hang on for a minute.
It makes me want to go read The Royal We by Heather Cox and Jessica. What's Jessica's last name?
Oh, my word. What is Jessica's last name? The Fug Girls. Yes. It's so good. Have you not read it?
I haven't read it.
Oh, it's so good. They basically foretold this story.
Is it Jessica Morgan?
I think it is.
So anyway, if you loved The Royal Wedding and you want more royal wedding in your life, go pick up The Royal We.
Definitely.
You will not. Well, going from that high note to a low note, in the book news this week, we had two major authors die on us. Philip Roth, who wrote American Pastoral and Portnoy's Complaint, and Tom Wolfe, who's most famous for The Right Stuff, both died. I have read neither of them.
I was just about to say, I've never read anything by Philip Roth. Is that terrible?
No.
I read some Wolfe for an essay course. So I've read some of his stuff. You know, but yeah, they're big guys. They were big names.
Exactly. It's like a notable thing that we should share with you. It happened. But in better news, PBS's The Great American Read got kicked off. Are you familiar with it at all?
I am. I have been looking at the list.
I wasn't familiar with it until I started seeing people post about it online, and I was like, And it turns out PBS is doing basically a television series on what they've identified as kind of like the top 100 books. And alongside that TV series, the public can vote on the books, and one will rise above the rest. They will crown a winner. So this is very exciting to me.
It is. I think they polled like 7,000 people to come up with the list. Mm-hmm. So it's a pretty surprising one. I mean, there were some on there that were very obvious, but then others that I was like,
oh, God, there's some bonkers choices on there. The 50 Shades of Grey series.
Yeah.
Which, fine, I guess.
Who are you if 50 Shades of Grey is your absolute favorite book? That's all I got to say. That is an interesting choice. You know we don't judge about this, but 50 Shades? Really?
It's a lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
It is.
And the whole Twilight series made it. No shade on Twilight, but is it one of the like top 100 book series in all the world from all eras of literature?
I mean, the Odyssey, the Iliad, or Twilight? What are you going to take with you to the desert island if you've got one choice?
None of the above. I'll write my own book on coconut shell.
Good plan.
And then I got kind of confused because this is The Great American Read, but there's a lot of Brit Lit on the list too.
Yeah.
It's like Charles Dickens, Jane Eyre.
Yeah, I think it's just what Americans love. It doesn't have anything to do with origin. Also, they limited it. Nobody could be on the list more than once in terms of authors. So
that's good.
Like Tom Sawyer's on there, but Huck Finn is not, which I found strange.
I will say I've already voted.
Ooh.
And you can vote once a day on pbs.org. You can sign up with your email or with your Facebook login until October. And then they'll announce the winner after the voting closes. And actually, I want to give us some pats on the back because two of our reads are on the list.
I love it.
The Handmaid's Tale and Jurassic Park.
We didn't even try. That,
no.
That just happened.
This podcast is literally an experiment in not trying. So just kidding, guys.
I would love to hear what you guys are voting for. I think that'd be interesting to know.
Yeah. If you vote, tell us who you voted for. And if you look at the list, tell us which books you find really surprising.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the book news. Pretty short book news section.
Well, I think that's fine because we have so much to talk about today.
Yes. We are starting our discussion of Ask Me About My Uterus by Abby Norman. So be aware, from here on out, there will be spoilers, but it's kind of hard to spoil a memoir.
I think a lot of our listeners probably haven't read the book anyway, so we'll just fill you in.
Do you want to start with some overall impressions?
Sure. What'd you think, Maria?
I think the topic is incredibly important. So the book is about Abby Norman's journey toward a diagnosis. So when she was an undergrad, she was at Sarah Lawrence, and she basically just started having this crippling uterine pain. And it's all about her 8-year-long journey to get diagnosed with endometriosis. And for those of you who aren't familiar with endometriosis, it's a disease that affects primarily women. We'll get into that a little later. And it's when the tissue that normally lines your uterus grows outside the uterus. So it can grow literally outside the actual uterus, but it can grow on any organ. So they have found endometriosis like on women's intestines, on their diaphragm, on their brain, and even like behind their eyes. I think the topic is really, really important. I think there are parts of the book that are absolutely brilliant. Abby is best when she's writing about the science of everything. You can tell that she's a really, really good science writer.
And I will just be perfectly honest and say I didn't get all the way through this book. I do try to finish, but this one I had checked out from the library and the library recalled it and I hadn't finished. So I read as much as I could, but basically I agree. The subject is so extremely important. And I think Abby was very brave to take it on and to also take it on in a personal way. That's not easy to talk about the things like that have happened to you. And she not only has a difficult medical history, but she just has a difficult personal history too. So yes. I really appreciated that she did decide to write this book and share it with us. And so total credit there. And this is a grandma comment, but I felt like the type was too small in the book. And there were tiny margins and it was very slow to read it because I felt like I was reading a page for 10 minutes. So all that being said, it was very ambitious and extremely well-researched. And I think just from the sheer number of responses that we've gotten in the last couple of days regarding our book club questions testifies to the fact that this is an extremely timely, important conversation that a lot of women really want to and need to have.
Right. So I would recommend that anybody who has a uterus or knows someone with a uterus gives this book a real shot.
Yes.
I also think to give this book a lot of credit, we both have studied this topic a lot. And so this is like a fantastic introduction to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if I knew nothing about the topic, I would have been sucked in from the first page. So on that level, I think that is part of my response to the book.
The book does a deep dive into endometriosis in a way that I haven't seen before. That alone is very odd, considering I know so many people who have it or who suffer from similar problems.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that I wrote a dissertation about women's health, there's just not a ton of information about women's problems, specifically endometriosis. And so those are some of the major takeaways from the book for me.
Right. You know, there really isn't a comprehensive place where you can go to learn about endometriosis. A lot of women are on internet forums listing their symptoms. So this is a very, I don't really want to call it a whisper network, but it's definitely grassroots of women helping other women understand this disease that people just are not researching.
Mm-hmm. And I think about how we live in this modern time where you can get on a computer with internet and talk to other women and connect in ways that 100 years ago or even 50 years ago women did not have. So if you had pain and you had a doctor who didn't understand or didn't listen to you, you were just up a creek. Like, what were you supposed to do? There was no information available.
And the one thing that this book really emphasized to me is that as a woman, we have to be our own advocates in mm-hmm. the medical field. Like, nobody's coming to save us.
Definitely.
And part of that is because there's a huge stigma around women asserting themselves, especially when it comes to medicine. So historically, women who have had chronic pain like endometriosis, instead of saying, hey, there's something wrong with you, they were labeled hysterical, right? And the word hysterical, the root of it, hyster, I think, is the Latin mm-hmm. root. Am I right?
Mm-hmm.
And that just means uterus in Latin.
I'll tell you, I have a hard time even using that word, knowing what it means and kind of the roots of it. You call a person hysterical, usually it's like, calm down, right? Just quit being hysterical. But it really is a denigration of women. Like, your biology is so faulty that you can't control your emotions or your actions.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because when we were talking about the royal wedding, I heard myself say I was crying hysterically, and inwardly I was like cringed. I was like, oh, I did it. But yeah, it's not a positive thing. Women are often considered irrationally emotional because we have ovaries, because we have a uterus, and men are inherently more logical, this theory goes, because they don't.
Well, I don't know about you, Maria, but in the dead of night, my uterus detaches itself from everything that it's attached to, and it goes on adventures, and it goes out into the world and wreaks havoc.
Girl, let me tell you, I caught it coming home one day and I hit it with a frying pan, and now it's real broke.
I mean, gotta keep them in check.
Ridiculous.
But for real, guys, for a long time, that is what people thought happened. That, like, your uterus would detach from your body and go crazy, or it would, like, let loose inside your body. It would wander around and it would, like, run up into your brain, and it would be like, meh! And then it would run down to other parts of you and be like, bleh! And, you know, this is what medical people believed.
And I mean, that's the point, right? Is only recently have doctors been elevated to such a high status. So, you know, there was no medical certification for being a doctor until the late 1700s, early 1800s in Europe, right? And you became a doctor if you were a second son.
Mm.
So if you weren't going to inherit your father's title, you could either go into the military, which wasn't a ton of fun, or you could be a lawyer or an accountant, or you could go be a doctor. So a lot of them became doctors. It became a very popular profession for the upper middle classes, upper middle class men. We should point that out.
Mm-hmm.
But people thought doctors were quacks. And honestly, they were.
Yeah.
They were sticking leeches all over people's bodies and bleeding them to death. Like, you couldn't trust them.
It was a very different dynamic, for sure. And for so many millennia, women were the midwives, right? Like, they took care of other women. And it wasn't until like the mid 19th century that men showed up and were like, no, we're doctors. We're the ones who need to be delivering babies.
And now you guys are witches.
They started doing horrible things to women, and women just had to submit to it, right? Because this now was like the professional. This was the doctor. Whereas for many, many years, women did it pretty well. So, I mean, there are stories about men during Victorian era trying to deliver babies with forceps while not looking at the woman in question, because it was a modesty issue. Like, can you imagine?
Now, hang on. I'm just going to root around in there till I grab something. That's like the worst claw game in the history of ever.
Exactly.
Like, literally, I'm crossing my legs right now.
I know.
That is so awful. And let's not forget that a lot of male physicians used their kind of medical designation as cover for rape.
Mm-hmm. So this, and even still, I mean, if you think about the gymnasts, this is still happening. Like, the American gymnasts who just put their medical doctor behind bars. So, I mean, this is not me trying to shit all over doctors. Okay. My sister is a medical professional. I have doctors in my friend group and I have doctors that I trust and adore. That is not the point. I think mm-hmm. what we're just trying to say is that there is a very, very long and storied history of stigma and of treating women as if they are complicated biological entities, which they are, but in ways that are almost like evil.
No, I understand what you're saying. I think to prove your point, most drug trials exclude women, and not just like human women, but they don't test on female mice. They don't test on female monkeys. Like, they only test on the male counterparts because women's physiology is deemed, quote unquote, too complicated. What happens is drugs hit the market that haven't been tested on female physiology, and then they don't work or they do things that are totally unanticipated. And nobody knows until women have started taking this stuff. And so I think that is to prove your point. Like, when you say that out loud, that seems kind of evil that you would develop a drug and then give it to women and hope to God everything works out okay.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the solution to that, I think, are more female physicians. But right now, only 30% of licensed physicians are female.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a very patriarchal system.
And it's also worth pointing out that patriarchy does not equal men, right? Like, that's not what true. We're saying. Patriarchy is a system that privileges men and women take part in it, right? So you and I both have had some pretty ugly run-ins with women doctors. Women are part of the system. It's not us against a bunch of men. I think I mentioned in the last podcast that I have had my primary care doctor is a man and I trust him implicitly. And so it's just the system, guys. And in terms of the system, women just tend to get the shorter end of the stick.
Thank you for pointing that out, because I also want to point out that we had quite a few men respond to the discussion questions mm-hmm. that we are going to talk about later about things that have happened to either them or women that they care about. And now they're advocates for women. So this is definitely not like a women versus men situation. Male allies are crucial to fixing these situations in the same way that women who aren't playing on the same team undermine progress.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't want to alienate any of our male listeners. Although I'm sure every doctor in the audience is like, I'm going to type you a very firmly worded email.
That's fair. But we, you know, it all works as a balance. Like, that's mm-hmm. what's interesting about this book in particular is it's a nice balance of personal experience, science, and Abby's own literary flair, right?
Yeah.
All of these different styles are coming together for this story, and it makes it very, very unique.
I totally agree. So I have a couple topics I want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like one of your topics may be race.
Mm. Yeah, so talking about, you know, sex differences only goes so far when it comes to medical discrepancies. And Abby does a good job of mentioning this, right? Depending on your race, your class, your sexual orientation, all of these things impact the kind of healthcare that you give, that you receive. Mm-hmm. Sorry. And so I appreciate that sort of intersectional discussion. Since we started talking about this book, obviously this issue has been on my radar and I've been looking, you know, for other outside material for us to talk about. And I came across this fascinating, extremely sad article that New York Times Magazine put out a few weeks ago about the discrepancy between white maternal deaths and black babies and black maternal deaths in the United States. So is it an extremely long and nuanced article, but just to kind of put it in a nutshell. Basically, in 1850, 217 per 1,000 white babies died, which is a lot, obviously. But that's 1850, okay? 340 per 1,000 black babies died at that time period, which makes sense because that is, you know, pre-abolition. So it makes sense that there's going to be a discrepancy there. Flash forward to 2018, and obviously child mortality rates have dropped quite a lot, as have maternal death rates, thankfully.
Although the U.S. still has the highest maternal death rate of any industrialized nation.
Which is still fascinatingly weird.
Yes.
But at this point in time, the discrepancy is still, it's worse than in 1850. In 2018, 11.3 per 1,000 black babies die, whereas 4.9 out of 1,000 white babies die. That's more than twice. So what's happening here? The article goes on and tries to explore all the different aspects, because obviously this is a striking statistic and people want to understand why. So they start breaking it down and thinking, well, maybe there's a genetic difference. No, there is not. Maybe it's a poverty level difference. It's like, no, it absolutely is not. This is also happening to middle class, upper class black women and their babies. The only thing that they have left is that it's about lived experience, which means that black women on the daily experience so much more stress and stress hormone levels that it is more likely to trigger other conditions like preeclampsia and hypertension, which lead them to either have traumas during their birth that kills them or kills their babies. In other words, living in this country as a black woman is so much harder just on a daily basis that you're more likely to die or lose a child.
That's so disheartening.
It is really sad, but it is fascinating that, you know, they're trying to break down all of these different aspects, right? Like, that's why intersectional studies of these medical conditions are really revealing, because you can kind of break it apart and say, no, it doesn't have to do with your income level. It doesn't have to do with the part of the country that you live in. It has to do with your lived experience.
Man, that's so hard, because I think we like to chuck it up to socioeconomic issues. And I'm not, lived experience is obviously part of that, right? Like, if it's harder for you to put food on the table, if you're working harder jobs, like all of those things. But it's so much more complicated.
It is.
I had not read that article, and I am kind of at a loss for words.
I guess it just points out that there's a daily toll that's taken on the body when you endure racism.
Right. And this sort of circles around to my next point, which is how closely women are tied to their bodies just socially. It's hard to kind of separate the female experience from the physical experience. One of the things Abby Norman talks about in her book is that one of the solutions to her pain, which she has been dealing with for 8 years, is a hysterectomy. It can remove a bunch of the endometrial tissue, assuming that's where the endometrial tissue is located, and give women a lot of relief. And it would give Abby a lot of relief. Only none of her doctors will do it for her because she's still of childbearing age.
Because why not?
Right? Like, she talks about in the book that she's child free, which means she does not want children.
Mm-hmm.
Also, her endometrial pain is so severe that she's celibate. So she cannot have sex because it hurts too badly and she bleeds severely afterwards. Mm. And yet her doctors will not approve a hysterectomy for her. And so I guess my question is, like, what's the deal with that? That we want women to suffer because it's more important for them to be fertile than to be pain-free?
I wish I had a good answer to that. There are discussions that go on every day that make it abundantly clear that women's bodies and their fertile potential matter more than their individual choices. Is that Absolutely. Right? It's not right, obviously. Your body belongs to you. And the decisions that you make about what to do with that body are yours, and they ought to be yours alone. And yet, the female body historically and today has been this arena for political discussions and people to lay claims on those bodies. It's a frightening prospect to think that you can't go to the doctor and say, this is right for me. I'm in pain. I'm suffering, and not be able to receive the medical treatment that you deserve.
And, you know, two notes to that. One, it even goes beyond that. Women who are child-free often struggle to be sterilized. Even women who have had children struggle to get sterilization procedures in case she, quote-unquote, changes her mind. And so, again, through this kind of online whisper network, women have compiled lists of doctors all over the nation who are willing to do those procedures for women under the age of like 37 or 38.
Mm-hmm.
The second note is specifically endometriosis related. So in the 1930s, physicians believed that endometriosis was a result of delaying childbearing too long, i.e. punishment for not having tons of babies when you were really young.
Why not blame the mother, you know? Or the non-mother. Why not blame the woman?
Isn't everything our fault?
It's all our fault. Yes.
We ate that apple in the garden.
Yeah.
So we deserve what we get.
Yeah.
Bullshit.
It is bullshit.
Anyway, that idea persists into modern medicine. So in the book, Norman points out that modern doctors often urge women to get pregnant to quote unquote cure their endo. And spoiler alert, that doesn't work.
I don't think it works.
Babies don't cure endometriosis. It's not like they reach up with their little bitty baby hands and like rip it all out on the way out.
Oh, that's... man, if only those little babies.
They should work harder is what we're getting at.
Yeah.
They honestly live rent free for 9 months. They don't have to pay for food. They don't have to pay for anything. And they can't even take the endometriosis with them when they go. Freeloaders.
So.
But anyway, there's this quote from the book where Norman writes, quote, "This framing of endometriosis comes from physicians' reinforcement of gendered social norms through the pathologizing of something deemed abnormal, such as the childless woman," which, in other words, what she's saying is basically women who choose to be childless or don't want to have children are being framed as bad or wrong or unnatural.
Mm-hmm.
Or when they say, you know, hey, endo happens because you haven't had enough children.
Right.
I just think it's fascinating how in this country, not to get too political, we force a lot of women to have babies they don't want by making it hard to get birth control and hard to get abortions. We don't provide support for women once they have those babies. And yet the most important thing about women is the fact that we can have babies and should have babies. And that's where all those like low birth rate articles come from. When you read, it's like, oh, our birth rate's too low. Well, what they really mean is white women's birth rate is too low because plenty of people of color are having children. It's just not white women. And that makes a lot of people really scared. I'll probably cut this part because that has nothing to do with anything.
I don't think you should cut that part. I think it's very important. And the values are so skewed. I'm just putting it out there. It's hard to say I'm a pro-life person. And as soon as that baby's out, like, who cares about the health of the mother? Who cares about the health of the baby? It's just like the process of getting that child born. Even that isn't free. Okay, I'm losing it. Sorry.
I know. We're both starting to get upset. So.
Yeah.
Because this is a really upsetting topic, right? It's very upsetting to read about a woman's extreme pain and read about how no one believes her. It was incredibly moving and upsetting to read the stories from you, dear listeners, who have had this happen to you or people you love. And it just makes my blood boil. It really does.
Me too.
I'm glad that endometriosis is being talked about more publicly, because what that does is it allows women to say, hey, the kind of pain that I feel once a month is not normal. Women are taught from a really young age that being in pain for 5 or 6 or 7 days a month is just the price you pay for being female. So that means women are less likely to reach out for help, even when the pain is debilitating, which also means that it takes, on average, 7.5 years to get diagnosed with endometriosis, because doctors have internalized the same idea, right? When a woman says, I have pain in my downstairs, and it's really bad once a month, they're like, well, no shit, you have a period. Well, guess what? It doesn't have to be that way. And so Norman interviews a woman named Dr. Melanie Marin, who's a gynecological surgeon in New York. And Dr. Marin says, and I quote, "You don't have to have a period ever. You should never have a period unless you are trying to get pregnant. And even then, maybe not. You don't have to have a period. You don't have to have cramps. You don't have to bleed. You don't have to, and you ought not to." And so her point is that we can use birth control to stop periods entirely. So women don't have to suffer once a month. There's like no biological reason for you to have to menstruate until you're ready to start a family. And I just thought that was really fascinating.
It is.
And so Norman pointed out that modern women have 4 times as many periods as our ancestors did. modern women will have something like 450 to 500 periods in their fertile lifetime.
Sorry. I just had like all the like thoughts of all the many periods I've had and all the many periods to come. And I'm not like thrilled about it, to be honest.
No. And it's really interesting, right? Because historically, periods have been considered incredibly unclean. Like you get locked in a hut when you're yep. on your period because you're filthy.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever get the feeling that women just can't win?
Oh my God, every day.
I came across all these crazy stories in my research about mm-hmm. like ancient civilizations and how they thought that women were like in cahoots with the moon and that they had, that they were witches and they had all these like crazy secret lives and societies and like men were just like super distrustful of them because they had this blood thing that happened to them regularly. And, you know, just all the weird myths that arose from that. And I hardly think of my periods as mythological. Let me just be honest.
No.
But like you can't win. Like if we try to pretend like it's this natural, beautiful thing, you can't like put that up next to all these crazy other assumptions without being like, yeah, whatever. It's all made up. It's medical. It's biological. Okay.
But yeah, it's really hard because all the systems kind of work against each other. So the minute you kind of take one step forward, you encounter a different kind of wall.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem with something like endometriosis is that it is a severe health condition. So the thing is, uterine pain can be endometriosis, which is ultimately not fatal, but uterine pain can also be a lot of other deadly conditions, including ovarian cancer. So ovarian cancer is the deadliest of all female cancers, and that's because women confuse the pain from the cancer itself with polyps, with ovarian cysts, endometriosis. And so by the time they go in and get somebody to take them seriously and get checked, it's already too late,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so last week I had mentioned the graphic artist Kate Beaton and her sister. And in the time between when we released our last episode and now, she's passed away.
Oh.
And she had ovarian cancer that the doctors did not catch, despite her being very diligent in going and telling them that there was something wrong until it was already terminal. And she was 36.
Yeah.
It's unacceptable. This is why I think talking about this stuff is so important, is because you want women to feel empowered to fight for their own health because you never know when it's going to save their lives.
I want our listeners, if they don't take away anything else that I have said today or that we have said today, just hear that. If mm-hmm. you are in pain, especially ladies, but men also, okay, yes. all of you, if you're in pain, don't doubt your pain. Find someone who will listen to you and who mm-hmm. will not only listen, but also help you figure out where it's coming from. I'm not lying or kidding when I say it's a life or death situation for some of you.
It is.
That sounds so like fake newsy and dramatic. But I don't think it is. Like, I think uh-uh. this is actually true, that there are people in your life who are hurting, who have something wrong with them, who are downplaying their pain. And if they don't do something about it, there will be adverse consequences in the future.
And please keep in mind that not all pain is necessarily physical. Mental pain counts.
Yes.
You know, don't suffer in silence. Now, having said all of that, doing all my research for this means that I have been targeted on Twitter with ads that are like, you could have ovarian cancer. Here are the signs.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, instead of scrolling past that, I was like, oh, I'll click that button. And then it was like, here are the 5 signs of ovarian cancer. And I'm like, I have 3 of those. I have cancer.
Right.
So there's been a couple of moments over the past 2 weeks where I'm like,
sure. And that's
go get checked.
I think that's what most of us are afraid of, is we don't want someone to call us a hypochondriac, because that's also mm-hmm. that's what people will say, you know, like, oh, you're just making it up. This is just all in your head. And yes, hypochondria is a real thing. I suppose Munchausen's is a real thing as well. The Real Housewives talk about Munchausen syndrome all the time. But those are extremes compared to everyday pain. Like most of us are not hypochondriacs. Most of us are people who feel and are either too embarrassed or ashamed, or maybe we don't have money. Maybe you're in a situation where you don't feel that you have the money to see a bunch of doctors. And that is a whole other can of worms that I can't even begin to open on this podcast. But, you know, don't let those feelings get in the way of you trying to find someone who can help you.
Don't downplay it.
No.
Which actually brings us to our reader questions and responses. And one of the questions that we asked all of you was, have you ever downplayed your own pain? And we got so many responses.
We did. It's very clear that women don't want to take up a lot of space. And so they downplay their pain. Is this Katty Smolowski? Hi, Katty. She wrote back simply all the time, which that was the pretty general answer to this question.
Yeah. At Skeletal Queen said, I've had chronic pain and fatigue since I was a toddler. I was not like the other kids, and I missed so much school. This definitely planted the seed for minimizing my difficulties. I also believe it was around this time that I began internalizing ableism, which is really interesting.
Yeah.
I have always beat myself up despite being extremely capable, intelligent, and resourceful. I was a valedictorian in my middle school, top 12 in high school, and magna cum laude in college despite all of my obstacles. I am thankful that my new health issues, which include endometriosis, are worsening now rather than earlier, but I shouldn't have to be thankful for something like that. I should be able to seek treatment and support from providers instead of either being dismissed or prescribed a pill and shoving it under the rug, which is what my current gynecologist is doing. Thank you guys for talking about the gender gap in medicine. And I have to say, I was so moved by that response that at Skeletal Queen would trust us enough to tell us that story, because I'm sure it's just incredibly painful and emotional to share that. And so I just want to thank her and thank all of you for being so open with us. And, you know, gosh, she's been suffering since she was a kid. That's awful.
Yeah. And so unnecessary.
Agreed.
Whirligig World writes, never. I always fear that if I don't say the truth about how I feel, then what if I get worse? But I rarely go to the doctor because so far I haven't had anything too bad. I just let my family members know how I'm feeling in case something happens. That's good. Be the never person. If you have pain, be the never person.
And reach out so that somebody can help you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the world's worst about not doing that. So, again, I'm very old, which you all already knew. Because I have a slanket. If you missed that episode, go back and listen.
Oh, my word.
And my back goes out multiple times a year. And I definitely downplay that pain, right? Like, I don't. I'm like, no, I'm fine. I can go to work. Like, I can do it, even though it's excruciating. And I'm trying to get better about saying, no, I really hurt.
Mm-hmm.
So that if something gets worse, like, somebody can help.
We've been socially trained to be as little of an inconvenience to others as possible, to the point where we compromise our own health to do so. And that's not okay.
And that's what At Books and Spoons talks about. She mentions, every single day, I live with constant high chronic pain. I am disabled because of it. But out in public, I pull this charade that I'm okay and normal and there's nothing wrong. And it bites me every time because I can pretend for only so long. It's been 6 years and it's still a struggle. Maybe one day.
Thank you for that, Books and Spoons. And then our friend Sydney at the Pseudophiles podcast at Tell You No Lie says, all the time, especially when doctors tell you for years to, quote, just take some ibuprofen, end quote, you just start to feel like a wimp. And so you downplay your own pain even to yourself. It took my ovary rupturing and nearly killing me for doctors to believe me when I said I was hurting. Which, Sydney, we want to kill somebody on your behalf.
Yes. I want to punch somebody in the face for all of you guys.
Yeah.
Like, I would like to be the designated doctor puncher who goes around. Like, I should put my services up on Craigslist. It's like, you need an advocate to go to the doctor with you. I am your girl. I will sucker punch somebody if they tell you that you're crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
That leads into our second question, which is, have you or a woman you know ever had doctors not believe or dismiss your pain?
So we had so many answers to this one, we couldn't include them all.
Yeah.
which is saying a lot, I think, considering we're such a small podcast and we had so many responses to these questions.
Everybody had a story.
They do. Richie Reed says, so many times I can't count. The worst is when I was put on a hormonal contraceptive 9 weeks after having my first baby, and it caused me debilitating anxiety, talking 2 to 4 panic attacks per day. When I told my doctor, he said switching to a different pill wouldn't help and I should just keep taking it. Spoiler, she did not keep taking it. Oh, and if he were a woman, he would just get a coil fitted and then he wouldn't ever have to worry about it. Ha ha ha. Isn't that great? Thanks, doc.
Oh,
so frustrating.
I have an IUD and I literally had to fight to get it.
Why is that?
They were like, well, we'll stick it in. And then like in 2 years, you're going to want to have a baby. It's just better for you to be on hormonal birth control. Even though hormonal birth control made me psycho. Like I was angry all the time. I was hard to live with. And like my first gynecologist would not switch my birth control. So I went to my second gynecologist who put me on 3 different ones, none of which like stabilized my mood. And then finally, I had to shop around for somebody that would, like, give me my IUD.
There you go. You had to go shopping.
And I had insurance, so I could do that. Like, could you imagine paying out of pocket and having to go to 4 or 5 different gynecologists to get what you need? At LA Book Club said, I haven't had that happen, but I've had a doctor schedule a surgery without my permission. And when the hospital called, I was in shock. What surgery?
I almost flipped my lid over that one. That's crazy. I can't believe that happened to you.
That is such a breach of your autonomy. Like, you are a person who has the right to say what happens to your body. And you have the right to say, like, I don't want to do this, even if it's medically advised. Whether that's a good idea or a bad idea, like, who's to say? And I'm not, obviously, at LA Book Club. Like, it all worked out great for her, and she knew her body, and she was advocating for herself, and that's great, right? But it doesn't matter in the end. You get to say what happens to you.
Definitely. And that AKA Kiss Kiss says all the time, which that was our answer. I mean, the answer across the board is like, has this happened to you all the time? And I'll tell you what, this is a Pandora's box of a question, because as soon as you start asking it, as soon as you start having female friends who will tell you the truth about what they're going through, you just hear all sorts of stories. And I'm so glad that Abby wrote this book about it.
I'm really glad that we chose it for our podcast. We were a little uncertain about this choice as we were talking about it, because we knew it could be a very hot button issue. And it's a debut book, so you never know how those are going to go from a bunch of different standpoints. But we both felt so passionately about talking about pain and talking about the gender gap in medicine and women's experiences that we decided to take a risk. And you guys came along with us, and we can't thank you enough for that. And we hope to keep having this conversation with you. So if you're listening to this and you have a story to share months from now, years from now, write to us. Tell us. We want to hear it. We want to support you. We want to give you a place where you can share that.
And we'd also like to thank the listeners who reached out to us via private message. If you didn't want to post on the message board, you reached out to us in different ways, and we also value the stories that you shared with us there.
We are just so thankful that you trust us with those stories, and we always want to be people that you can trust with those stories. So,
absolutely.
Even if sometimes we're real judgy about Kanye West, it has no bearing on you guys at all.
Sorry for all that yelling, by the way, guys. I got really screamy.
Sometimes you gotta scream. It's fine.
I'm still not over it, by the way. Never will be.
Hold that grudge till the day you die. I hope on your tombstone, when you die, when you're 150 or whatever, it says, and I never forgave Kanye. That's
still
all it should say.
Still mad at Kanye. Yep. Put it on my gravestone.
Let
I'm ready.
All those people who visit cemeteries try and unravel that.
I have a feeling that that gravestone will be like relevant for the next 200 years. So I'm down with it.
I think we've talked about this on this podcast before, but I want my tombstone to say she never saw Star Wars.
Yes, we have.
Okay. Just want to reiterate that for anybody who's jumping in this episode. I've never seen Star Wars, and I'm real proud of it.
R.I.P. Maria Blackheart. She never saw Star Wars.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is where we talk about further reading. So if you like this book and you're interested in this topic, we want to give you some things that you can go read and like keep the conversation going. So Pixie is going to do the heavy lifting on this one. So I'm just going to throw my suggestion in at the very beginning. And it's only tangentially related, but I think it's important. So it's Technically Wrong, Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech by Sarah Watcher Boetcher. And I read this book like days ago. And this talks about how these issues that we're talking about in medicine are not just limited to medicine. They also go into the tech world. And there's one chapter that I want to recommend above all the others, and it's about period tracking apps and the ways in which period tracking apps are mostly designed by men and actually right. don't really fit women's needs because they all focus on your fertility rather than your experience having a period. And it just talks about how even technology aimed at women is often really exclusionary. So anyway, that's my recommendation. It is very fascinating.
I love it.
Your turn. Take us on a ride, Pixie.
Oh, boy.
I see you have 50 titles here. We've got time. I'm just kidding.
Let's cut them down. So I mentioned last week a book called In the Kingdom of the Sick by Laurie Edwards, mm-hmm. which is a really good book about chronic pain. And I think I had diagnosed her wrong. I think I said she had neuropathy, but she has fibromyalgia, which that is the disease that some people argue isn't even real. Anyway, she talks about the lived experience of having an invisible illness as well, mm-hmm. like endometriosis. So that one's interesting, I would say. Another book that I know I have mentioned on this podcast, The Camera My Mother Gave Me by mm-hmm. Susanna Kaysen, who also wrote Girl Interrupted. Mm-hmm. This one is kind of a memoir. It's not scientific like Abby's, but it's a memoir about just having pain and no one believing it. And she basically is like, listen, my vagina is busted and it needs to be fixed. And the long journey of not knowing what's wrong and having nobody help her. So it's very similar to Abby's story. And then I think I'm going to change my theoretical pick.
Okay, go.
Off the cuff.
You're a rebel.
Ooh, I know. Susan Sontag's Illness as Metaphor is one of the best critical theoretical texts about illness and the language used to describe illness. Susan Sontag had cancer and she mm-hmm. She objected to the language that was used to talk about cancer. And people okay. who were fighting it being a specific word, like cancer is this battle and you're either going to win or you're going to lose against it. And all of the different stigmas that come from that type of language. Mm-hmm. But I love this little book. It's very short and it really changes the way you think about illness and the way you talk about it.
If you're like, I'm really interested in this and I want to dig a little deeper under the surface, Sontag's mm-hmm. book is perfect. And actually, now that I think about it, can I add one more pick?
Yeah.
My other pick would be Wit by Margaret Edson, which is actually a play. It's very short, but it's very moving, and it follows the death of an English professor from uterine cancer. So basically, you see her journey, quote unquote, fighting cancer, but mm-hmm. from the very first scene of the play, you know it's terminal. So you see her treatment and the way that the doctors treat her and ultimately like her death scene. And it's very, very powerful. It won the Pulitzer. And we don't recommend very many plays. So
we don't. That's true. We have not done that. So good.
Okay. This was a pretty heavy episode, I have to say. We have those every once in a while, but this one mm-hmm. may be one of our heaviest. So thanks for sticking with us.
And I feel like we didn't even scratch the surface, really.
I hope we can read books in the future that allow us to circle back to this topic. And
me too.
If you guys have books that you would like to read to have these kinds of discussions, please send those picks to us. You can email us at misfitbookclubpodcast@gmail.com. We want to read what you want to read. You can even send us the topics you want to hear about, and we will curate books for you.
Love it. Yeah.
But that actually brings us to next month's pick.
Da-da-da!
All right. So you guys already know that we want to keep talking about The Body in Pain. So keep talking to us about that on social media. But we're going to table that. And in honor of the Unread Shelf Project on Instagram, we are reading a book that we both own but have never cracked the cover on.
Yep.
So you can find the Unread Shelf Project at hashtag the Unread Shelf Project 2018. And their goal is to encourage people to read the books they have rather than buying new ones all the time.
Which,
I don't believe in that.
But. I was about to say, I don't either. But this is a book I have wanted to read for some time, so I'm glad we're going to do it.
Yep. And we are reading, drum roll, Homegoing by Yaa Jessie. And it looks like Gyasi, but it's pronounced Jessie.
So exciting. Do you want me to read the summary?
Yes, please.
Okay. Two half-sisters, Effia and Essie, are born into different villages in 18th century Ghana. Effia is married to an Englishman and lives in comfort in the palatial rooms of Cape Coast Castle. Unbeknownst to Effia, her sister Essie is imprisoned beneath her in the castle's dungeons, sold with thousands of others into the Gold Coast's booming slave trade, and shipped off to America, where her children and grandchildren will be raised in slavery. One thread of Homegoing follows Effia's descendants through centuries of warfare in Ghana as the Fante and Asante nations wrestle with the slave trade and British colonization. The other thread follows Essie and her children into America. From the plantations of the South to the Civil War and the Great Migration, from the coal mines of Pratt City, Alabama, to the jazz clubs and dope houses of 20th century Harlem, right up through the present day, Homegoing makes history visceral and captures with singular and stunning immediacy how the memory of captivity came to be inscribed in the soul of a nation.
That sounds meaty and good.
So good. I have had so many friends be like, you have to read this book. It's fantastic. You're going to love it. Blah, blah, blah. And we wanted a fiction pick. So I think this is going to be a good one. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah. My husband's aunt mailed me a copy of this 8 months ago. She's like, you have to read this. And yeah, I haven't read it. So basically, I'm ashamed. And I'm glad that we can scrub this blot off of my soul.
Same.
So,
although I have a feeling that we're both going to feel a little inadequate because Yaa Jessie is like really young.
But we can eat ice cream while we do our podcast and soothe
our
soul.
I'm with it. I'm drinking in the closet again tonight. Why stop there?
I'm wearing a caftan. I'm wearing the caftan you bought me. In case you're wondering if Pixie is literally the best friend you can ever have, she is, because she mails you caftans when you have a bad week. And it is so comfy and I feel very formal and yet relaxed.
Life's too short not to have at least one caftan.
Girl.
Maybe a collection.
So thank you again. But I'm fully embracing my like mid-30s going on mid-70s personality.
Me too. I'm good with it.
On that note, we've reached the end.
Thank you guys for listening. We love talking to you, as we have mentioned hopefully 100 times in this episode. That's why we're here. That's why we're doing this podcast. So if you are inclined, we hope you'll reach out to us. You can subscribe and review to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, or TuneIn. And you can follow us on all the traditional social media networks.
Yep. At Misfit Book Club. And you can email us at misfitbookclubpodcast@gmail.com. And so, yeah, just tell some people about us if you like what you hear. Give us some suggestions so we can read things that you want to read as well. And we will see you next time.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.